Hello, everyone. Hi. What's up? Rob Rousseau here. I will be your host of the Insurgents podcast today. Thank you for joining me. Jordan is off away on another one of his lavish Hollywood retreats. I don't exactly know what that's all about. You know, that's not really my world. I saw he was packing some kind of robes, and he would mention something about some ritual that they were doing there. I don't know what, again, I don't really operate in those same kind of circles, so not sure what that's about. The point is, Jordan, not here today, but who is here is Nima Shirazi. Nima is the co-host of the Citations Needed podcast, along with Adam Johnson, another former guest of the show. I wanted to bring Nima on the program to talk about the developments over the last couple of days with Iran and Israel, and Iran responding to Israel's bombing of their consulate a few weeks ago, and how that played out in the media. Really good conversation with Nima coming up. And you might remember that normally today, in the scheduling, this would be one of our premium episodes for the subscribers, the beloved paid interns. This felt like kind of a pertinent conversation right now, and I kind of just wanted to get it out there to everyone. So I'm going to unlock this episode. I'm making an executive decision, unlocking the episode. But with that in mind, if you can, please do subscribe to this show. Subscribe to the podcast if you want to get access to other bonus episodes. We've done a number of wonderful bonus episodes over the last few months and years now. Some fantastic guests. If you want to get access to both episodes of the Insurgents podcast that's released every single week, please do subscribe. It really helps us put on this show. We got big things planned for the next couple of months. We're entering a really crazy time. I mean, has it ever really stopped being crazy the whole time we've been doing this podcast? Not really, but I guess we're entering a period of somehow even more heightened craziness and ridiculousness. So we got some big things planned. We need all the help we can get keeping this show on the air, though. So if you can, please subscribe at insurgentspod.com. That's my little pitch. We don't have like product tie-ins or ads or anything on this show. It's entirely funded by the people that listen to it. So that's it. I'm going to unlock today's episode, but you got to listen to the little pitch in exchange. That's my offer to you this week. Anyway, let's get to it. Let's get into this conversation with Nima Shirazi. It was really fantastic, and he's going to be joining the show right after this. Okay, and now we're joined by Nima Shirazi, co-host of the wonderful Citations Needed podcast, someone who's been covering issues related to Iran and Palestine and Israel for a very long time. Nima, thank you so much for joining the show. I really appreciate you coming on.
Great to be with you, Rob. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. How's it going? How are you doing?
What's doing what's great? Up? Why? What's up in your world?
Is there anything going on you want to talk about? Or
No, things are, you know, things are things are okay. You know, I really appreciated you reaching out. You know, I on Saturday night this past weekend, I feel like I was settling into to a lovely kind of weekend evening, free of work and worry, you know, looking at my DVD shelf, figuring out what I was going to maybe watch that night. And then all of a sudden my phone started blowing up, and the night turned into something quite different, where, you know, for the first time in a long time, I turned on cable news to see how things were being covered, you know, as the government of Iran was putting out public statements, their representative to the United Nations was putting out an official statement. We heard reports of drones and cruise missiles and maybe even ballistic missiles, heaven forfend, being shot toward Israel. And you know, I just found myself in this kind of whirlwind of trying to figure out what was going on and also really paying attention to the way that things were being discussed, which is kind of a thing I like to do, and something that we do on the pod a lot. And so yeah, I think my, you know, many, many years of kind of paying attention to the way that the media describes events for lack of a better term, when related to Iran, and certainly when related to Palestine and Israel, it really winds up being very illuminating to see the frameworks at work and kind of how perception is supposed to be shaped. So yeah, the weekend turned into something different.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly why I've always enjoyed listening to Citations Needed, because you talk about the ways that the media kind of uses these kind of different tactics and uses language specifically to shape and distort and obscure whatever event that they want to talk about. I guess just before really getting into that aspect of it, it would probably be worthwhile to just sort of give a little recap just for context to listeners. Especially if you're listening to this, you know, from some vantage point in the future, you might not be familiar. But so over the weekend, as Nima was outlining, we had heard about this Iranian response over the last couple of weeks. Israel, of course, a few weeks ago, bombed their consulate in Damascus, assassinating a number of IRGC figures there. And I mean, Iran has been saying we intend to respond to this. This is the weird kind of dynamic when we talk about this, because there's no country in the world that wouldn't respond to that, to their embassy being bombed. I mean, this has been, like, according to international law, you know, this is an act of war. So it's been very strange to watch this dynamic play out in the media as we talk about this possible response. But the response came over the weekend,
Strange
and
slash unsurprising,
yeah,
perhaps.
it's not surprising. But the response came over the weekend, as you outlined. There was a number of missiles and drones that were launched towards military targets in Israel. And what I found kind of interesting about this is because there's a lot of speculation right now, and we can get into this, whether Israel is really trying to fan the flames of, like, a broader regional conflict in here and draw in the United States into a more official capacity into this situation. And, you know, we can debate or talk about how accurate that is. Israel just generally seems to be totally out of control. They're, you know, bombing the Iranian consulate. They're bombing Syria. They're bombing Lebanon. They're, of course, waging this unspeakable atrocity on the people of Gaza. So there's a lot of speculation about whether they're trying to draw Iran into that. And it seemed to me that this response was really kind of designed to, you know, act as a legitimate military response to this attack that happened, while also not really falling into that trap of escalating this even more into this broader conflict, which could totally spiral out of control, which would certainly not be good, I think, for the people in Gaza or the people of Iran or really anywhere else in the region. And it seemed like to me that that's what this response was kind of designed to do, is walk this kind of line, which has made the response to it all the more interesting. Like, is that what's your kind of stance on
Yeah,
that?
totally. I mean, look, it is hard to think of a more calculated, telegraphed, and choreographed action by a government responding to the assassination of its officials, to, as you said, I think an act of war. You know, Israel destroying the consulate building and the embassy, the kind of embassy space in Damascus. You know, that's Iranian territory, right? So there is kind of a direct attack on Iran by doing that. You know, look,
They also damaged the Canadian consulate as well, and Canada was like, no, it's okay. Don't worry about
yeah,
it.
don't
That's
worry
fine.
about it, all good, we'll take care of that, just some spackle. Look, ethnic cleansing, genocide, assassination, settler colonialism, and apartheid has kind of been Israel's move for the past 100 years, if not 76 years, if not any kind of vantage point you wanna demarcate as your historical touch point of choice. And the idea that Iran would not respond to this, and this I also want to note, this is not the first time Israel has attacked Iran. This is not the first time Israel has assassinated Iranian officials, officials and also scientists. This has been going on for a very long time, well over a decade. And not to mention a lot of acts of sabotage and other threats and also violent attacks that it's been waging against Iran for a very long time. Iran rarely responds, and when it does so within the framework of international law. Now, of course, this can be debated. Who gets to retaliate? When is a retaliation? When is it a new act? When it, right, is you can kind of cycle this again and again. But Iran, even looking back to when the United States Navy shot down a Iranian commercial jet in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War, Iran's move is to go to the international community. As part of the international community, Iran goes to the UN. It issues official statements. It issues official complaints. It says, look, this must be condemned on an international stage through these international bodies that we're all supposed to respect. What Iran has met with time and time again is the refusal of the international community. And I say that reservedly. What I mean is the United States, the United Kingdom, maybe France, those that are very close allies to Israel and Saudi Arabia, and those who have a very antagonistic relationship with the government of Iran ever since their preferred tyrannical dictator was overthrown in 1979, right? So everything is kind of an act of getting over the humiliation of the Iranian Revolution and not allowing Iran to be its own kind of sovereign country in its own right, and to operate with that in mind, knowing it the government there has its own interests, and that Iran should be treated as a sovereign nation. Somehow this goes out the door when Iran is attacked, and Iran responds by saying, look, this must be condemned. And those condemnations rarely come. In the case of what happened on April 1st, when Israel bombed Damascus, Iran again went to the UN. There was a Security Council resolution put forth by Russia that was vetoed by the US, the UK, and France, just to condemn the Israeli assault, the Israeli assassination. And Iran said, look, if you condemn this officially and move toward a ceasefire, like we're not going to respond. Basically, Iran saying, and look, this is also beneficial in terms of Iranian messaging, right, to their own people, to the people of that part of the world, and the larger planet who opposes ongoing genocide, who opposes ongoing colonialism, saying, effectively, we can accept the murder of seven of our officials if that leads to a ceasefire, if that leads to the end of this genocide, effectively saying, they will have been martyred in service of Palestinian liberation, right? Solid messaging, but also quite remarkable when you consider what they actually experienced, and that they were saying, look, we don't need to respond if these actions are taken by, effectively the world, right? But really by these Western powers. That was vetoed. No ceasefire is forthcoming. And Iran then proceeds to completely telegraph what it's going to do. Everyone knew this was coming. Everyone knew this was happening. Maybe not the exact specifics, although that's debatable, because Iran was also letting other countries know. I've seen reports that Iran was back channeling with the U.S. in advance of this, to basically let them know what was going on and to say, look, you know, stay out of this, which the U.S. of course did not. But and so we see in kind of the most choreographed response, and you know, I also use the word response a little reservedly, because when you look at what Iran has experienced, even just since October 7th, a lot of acts of violence against their officials in foreign countries, in other countries, right? It's not like there are Iranian officials being killed in Tel Aviv, which granted also would not be great, but I'm saying, like, you know, third party countries, their consulates elsewhere, these are acts that somehow when it occurs against Iran, our media tells us and our political class tells us, well, you know, they should really just take it on the chin, right? They should, anything that they do is just one more act of aggression. Of course, only, you know, aggression only goes one way. It comes from Tehran, never toward Tehran, never toward an Iranian, never toward a Palestinian. It always goes the other way, right?
So too does this right to self-defense only applies to certain countries.
Exactly. And so with that exact point, Rob, this action taken this past weekend is really an act of self-defense by Iran, under international law as well. I mean, if you look at Article 51 of the UN charter, you know, there are imminent threats against Iran ongoing because of what Israel has done, again, just since October 7th. And so the idea that these would not be addressed, you know, really kind of exposes the double standards and hypocrisy, which, I mean, of course, are legion. But the idea that if Israel is committing genocide and that is seen as self-defense in response to an act that happened in the past, right? But that is an ongoing act of quote unquote self-defense. Yeah. Then what the fuck is Iran doing, if not also acting in self-defense in the most, again, telegraphed, choreographed, measured way? Yeah. That it possibly could, basically giving hours and hours of heads up, sending a, you know, press release saying this is what we've done, issuing a UN statement before a single, like, little drone has entered anywhere close to Israeli airspace, saying we consider this matter concluded unless you continue to fuck with us. Right?
Yeah.
And so that is what Iran does. There are zero casualties. Every single target was a military target, something Israel cannot possibly comprehend because that's not their move. And then we see over the course of not only Saturday, but in the days since, Rob, I think we've seen the move to really frame this very specifically, both politically and in the press, as, you know, the initial report said, had words in headlines like retaliatory, right? The first paragraph, like the lead of every news report that night. Maybe that's being generous. Maybe not every, but most.
Yeah.
Said, you know, following the April 1st attack by Israel on an Iranian consulate building in Damascus, .. right? Retaliatory in response. Within hours, that had moved to this kind of coordinated messaging campaign on the part of the political and media class here in the United States, to say that this was now a quote unquote disproportionate attack by Iran on Israel. So the word disproportionate started replacing retaliatory. And then we saw disproportionate, apparently that wasn't strong enough, right? So we saw disproportionate go away, and then it became unprecedented, if not unprovoked. And so you saw this kind of retaliatory to unprovoked pipeline of messaging that I think has continued in the days since, really trying to frame up Iran as the aggressor rather than the victim slash kind of respondent to aggression against its government.
Yeah, there was a lot to unpack there. There was an interesting interview with David Cameron in the UK that I think from Sky News, where I was actually surprised that the interviewer even asked this question. What would Britain do if our consulate was attacked? And he kind of like, and he's kind of stammered Britishly, and then suggested somehow that this attack was somehow was disproportionate or escalatory, which is remarkable considering we're talking about a bunch of prominent officials in the IRGC being assassinated versus this attack in which no one was killed and which was really what more symbolic than anything. I think to get into something else you were talking about, I mean, I think one of the really eye-opening things about the last 6 months is this whole idea of the rules-based order and international law and all this stuff. And you see the way Israel, with full support of the United States and Canada and all these other human rights respecting countries, is just able to kind of flagrantly violate whatever norms, whatever international laws there are. You have the International Court of Justice handing down rulings saying you have to stop this. You have now the UN passing a resolution saying this has to stop, just totally being ignored with zero consequence. And then you have like Iran, the rogue terrorist regime that it always gets talked about in these terms, trying to like use these institutions, not only now, but in the past, like you're pointing out, and speaking at the UN and trying to talk about international law and what that allows and what it doesn't allow, which is remarkable as well, because after this Iranian, if you want to call it an attack, whatever response, now you have Israel now going, we need to meet at the UN about this. The UN has to get involved.
That was maybe my favorite part of this,
Yeah, I thought the UN was
that then
Hamas now. That's why I was
Israel
very confused.
went to the UN saying there must be an official condemnation
Yeah, the
of this.
Hamas-controlled UN.
Yeah, exactly. So, when it suits Israel, kind of claims to abide by this rule of law. Of course, it never actually does. This is all theater. But yeah, I love that. Ever since its founding in 1948, the Israeli government has been really frustrated with the UN for saying, "Oh, I don't know, there's a right of return for refugees that whose families you massacred and whose villages you destroyed. They're allowed to go back to their indigenous land, to their places they are from, which is now within the quote unquote borders of Israel, even though Israel has no official borders. It should be said as no official constitution, because doing so, kind of landing somewhere in terms of where Israel's borders are for that nation would mean an end to the expansionist ideology, which of course is inherent to that state being a state. So it doesn't want to kind of say that it has borders. And the UN has kind of noted this over the years. Along with ending the occupation, along with much more recent declarations by the whether it's the General Assembly, which is much more representative of the entire world, or just the Security Council, which is much more representative of the winners of World War II, that still have control over that institution. Yeah, so you know, Israel consistently says the UN cannot be trusted. The UN has an inherent anti-Israel bias. The UN is now Hamas, as you said, and now they go crying back to the UN to say, "Oh, look at what Iran did to us." And you know, I'm sure they don't want to actually tally up a, you know, kind of competing death toll because it wouldn't look good for them.
Yeah. Although I guess it's worth pointing out though that there were some other aspects to this response. You know, it didn't have this huge, like you said, it's more symbolic. It's kind of coordinated. It did, I think, have a sort of impact though of like testing Israel's defense
Yeah,
systems,
I think it's
getting
symbolic
information about
and
that.
strategic.
Yeah, like they used all old equipment and stuff that they like. Not they, Iran does have a pretty high tech military arsenal, which was not used in this. This is all old stuff that they knew full well was not going to have this kind of big dramatic impact. But it seems like it did kind of have a kind of strategic element to it. You also saw a lot of footage of people in Israel running for these shelters and you know, kind of freaking out a little bit, which I think sends kind of an important message as well, that you know, you can't just live out these kind of genocidal fantasies and just bomb whoever you want into submission without eventually having something visit you in return. So I think there's a kind of element of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it does a little damage to the idea of total immunity and also impunity for Israel. And you know, and those who support the ongoing genocide and the decades and decades of ongoing occupation and siege and oppression of Palestine. But also, as you said, I think there were very strategic elements to this. And this is another kind of interesting kind of framework, the narrative about success and failure, right? With regard to the Iranian actions. And to kind of unpack that a bit, you know, as you said, so the armaments that Iran used, these slow drones, some cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, as you said, everything that everyone already knew Iran had, right? They didn't reveal anything about their capabilities. What was revealed, however, is Israel's capabilities. And yes, we all already know about the Iron Dome air defense system, which the United States effectively pays for Israel, you know, and how effective that is against certain kinds of missiles or certain kinds of rockets, et cetera, right? But we also saw the speed at which Israeli allies in the region, and in the region, I'm also counting the United States and Great Britain, because of how many military assets they, you know, continue to have, thousands and thousands of miles away from their own countries, in other people's backyards. And so, you know, but also to kind of see how the US, UK, Jordan, certainly, and probably also other countries as well, like Saudi Arabia, really responded to these, you know, missiles and drones being fired at Israel, kind of giving away certain positioning of where those military defense systems are, you know, of where the, say, Iron Dome and other air defense systems that Israel has, where those are launched from. All this information was kind of given up. And I think, you know, some may say, well, you know, that was already known as well. But I think the kind of full might of what happened when Iran announced, and I want to make that again like clear, when Iran announced that it had done this with hours before anything was actually going to enter Israeli airspace, hours and hours to see what the response would be. And now we know what the response is, right? We know, for instance, that if the United States and the UK, and Jordan for that matter, wanted to maybe intercept missiles fired at civilian targets, hospitals, mosques, homes, entire neighborhoods, ambulances, schools, shelters in Gaza, they probably have, surprise, surprise, the might and the equipment to do it, right? They choose not to. But when it's Iran firing something at Israel with hours and hours of warning, and weeks before that of telegraphing what was going to happen, it is revealed kind of the larger state of defense that surrounds Israel, right? Who is coming to rush to their aid, that they are not a completely self-sufficient nuclear power, which they are. Israel has its own nuclear arsenal. And yet, you know, a few hundred missiles and drones fired at it, while most of them getting intercepted on the way, which again, also the point, some did get through. And it's not like at the same time, groups like, Hezbollah launched their own attack. They did not. So think about the overwhelming ability that Iran and certain allies that it has in the region could actually deploy if they wanted to further test the defense systems of Israel. So I find that interesting. I also think, just, you know, in terms of this idea of success and failure, I think, you know, obviously to its own people and to the larger world, Iran is obviously projecting that this was a huge success. It did exactly what it was going to do, and it considers this matter concluded. But also that it reaffirms itself as pretty much the only country to stand up against Israel. The only country to consistently support liberatory movements, the only country that actually can keep getting fucked with, can stay measured, and still exact a kind of toll, whether that's psychological or economic. I mean, it cost over $1 billion for this defense of Israel, you know, to actually play out. You know, so I think Iran achieves a lot through this. Of course, some of it is messaging, just for their, you know, for their own public to consume, and to those also, you know, around the region, of course. While then on the other side, we see the Israeli narrative, which is, you know, Iran continues to be an existential threat, but also it's super bumbling. You know, I love that kind of two-step, that, you know, Iran couldn't possibly harm us because, well, we had, you know, a number of other armies shooting things down for us. But also, you know, 99% of these missiles or whatever were intercepted. There was, you know, minor damage, you know, no one was killed, etc. So then it was a huge failure. But apparently this huge failure still portends this like big evil existential threat, right? Like it does both things. Like Iran in the Israeli mind is like both. Sorry, I shouldn't say Israeli mind. I should say Israeli propaganda. Israeli mind is kind of a fucked up thing to say. in the Israeli kind of official propaganda, the kind of Hasbara of the Israeli state and its supporters, saying, you know, Iran can't touch us. You know, that's all they got. Look at what that was met with. No problem here. Business as usual, while still maintaining this idea that Iran, you know, continues to be its number one threat that must be taken out.
Yeah, our opponent is simultaneously weak and strong. We see that often. And okay, there's a couple things here. So number one, I think like something that you did touch on as well, and this gets into the way that the role that the media plays in shaping these narratives as well, and the kind of specific language that's used. And I think you touched on something that I think is interesting that I've been kind of fascinated as well. And that's with the way the media describes certain groups as Iran-backed, like whether you're talking sure. about Hezbollah, whether you're talking about Hamas or Ansar Allah, the Houthis, and the way that these kind of groups are, their agency is kind of taken away, and they get framed in the media and in the political circles as just being these arms of the Iranian foreign policy regime or whatever. And not to say that there isn't some elements of like communication or coordination with some of these groups.
And funding,
but,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. But this is also something that is never applied to the United States, to Israel. Right. You never hear about the U.S.-backed Israel.
U.S.-backed Israeli state.
Or any time America is backing some awful extremist group, you know, which it's done throughout its history constantly. You never hear about the U.S.-backed death squads in El Salvador or Nicaragua or anywhere. You don't hear about the U.S.-backed Azov battalion or anything like that. Yeah. So this has always struck me as a really interesting way that the media uses language to delegitimize certain resistance groups while never applying that kind of that sort of descriptor when it comes to the other side.
Oh, totally. I mean, it is a clear indication of what perspective a report wants to take or wants the reader to receive when it uses those kinds of descriptors and those kinds of epithets. Iran backed is kind of one of my favorite ones because it does so much work. It combines this idea of funding and ideology and the kind of tentacles of this Iranian empire spreading out across the region, as if Iran is not part of the region. Also, I just want to note, like that's where Iran is actually. And that's where Lebanon is. And that's where Yemen is. And that's where Syria is. That's where Iraq is. That's where Palestine is. And so the idea that, you know, Iran is always seen as this kind of foreign meddler when those nations or governments or dictatorships that are funded and supported and armed and protected by the United States, which I just want to make clear, is not in the region. The United States is not in that part of the world.
It's the global Monroe Doctrine.
He's right. I mean, for real, right? This idea that imperialism in full force is somehow indigenous to the region. And therefore, Iran is the foreign meddler, Iran-backed .. instantly labeled evil, instantly labeled dangerous. You know, I think does so much heavy lifting when you hear that, not only in political speech but also throughout the media, this idea of you know, Hezbollah is just a proxy, right? The word proxy, proxy of Iran. The Houthis are just proxies of Iran, rather than having their own interests, rather than actually being resistance groups in their own right. You know, all of that is kind of done away with because the narrative of big bad Iran just trying to exact its own imperial means across the region is a much more salient story for our media to be telling.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as well. I don't know, you know, how far down this path you want to go, but it is interesting as this constant effort is made to frame Iran as being the big baddie of the region and the foreign meddler and all these things, like you're saying. But the role that Iran has played in fighting ISIS, for example, over the last 10, 15 years, or, you know, however long it's been, which, you know, we're told in the media is our enemy that America is also fighting. And you have this kind of weird dynamic where Iran has been, you know, contributing to the fight against ISIS, including people like Qasem Soleimani. And then you have the United States arbitrarily assassinating Soleimani, which kind of makes it seem like ISIS and the United States and Israel kind of have a common enemy in Iran sometimes. And then you had that recent attack in Iran on the anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, which ISIS claimed credit for, which, you know, I don't want to speculate too much on that, but sure. That does kind of like make me kind of a little suspicious about the connections and the motivations of this group. But I think that's a whole other aspect to this.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think something that I've seen, you know, in my many years of looking at how the media uses certain language, certain words, and what it defends, what it obscures, what it allows for, what it encourages. I think, you know, you kind of start to see, all these connections. I mean, Iran is always expected to be very obedient. And because it is one of the least obedient countries to American and Israeli dictate, I think it has been targeted now for over 40 years, 45 years, really, for being so disobedient to the, as you said, quote unquote, world order.
Yeah. And so the interesting thing about, like, going back to, you know, Iran and Israel and what's happening right now. So now you have this conversation in the media. Will Israel respond to Iran's response? Even though, like you pointed out, Iran said, you know, we consider this matter concluded, essentially. And now there's this whole kind of conversation in the media. Israel has said that they're going to now respond to this, you know, like disproportionate and brazen and unprecedented assault. And I think that was fascinating too, because I saw these conversations happening in the media saying, well, maybe Israel will respond in a way that's de-escalatory, that doesn't really like escalate things to the next level. And it's like, isn't that what just happened? Like, isn't that what happened over this weekend?
Right.
So that's this amazing situation now where now we're debating what response Israel is going to have. And I think that's the kind of somewhat scary thing about this moment, is that we're all kind of depending on Israel to react normally to something and not escalate
things. Right, which it does not do.
No, it does not. So that's the kind of scary thing about this moment.
Certainly. History always begins whenever someone throws a rock toward Israel.
Yes.
That is the beginning of history at whatever point. And so every response then needs a new response. And that first response becomes the initiating act to which Israel just needs to, you know, have some sort of either retaliation or act of quote unquote self-defense. You know, thinking about when history begins in terms of our public debate is, I think, very important. In the kind of American discourse, largely, Iran didn't exactly exist until November 4th, 1979, with the hostage crisis. That's where kind of Iran began. And so when you kind of set up when history begins, you get to completely frame who has a kind of initiating act, who has a first act, and then everything else is a response from that. You kind of go in cycles like that. And we are seeing the same here. I mean, I do think it is, not trying to be optimistic here, but I think it is clear that the United States and the UK and I'm sure a bunch of other countries do not want an actual kind of direct war, I would say. War, I might not be the right word, but, you know, direct conflict between Israel and Iran. There is a reason why for, you know, 4.5 decades, the United States has not been successful with its threats and with its kind of like what it's wanted to do to Iran, I should say, whether that comes in the form of fomenting internal regime change or invasion from the outside. That's not going to work. And I think a lot of countries know that. Iran is stronger than we are often led to believe. And as a result, the United States does not want to be a part of that. I think you had mentioned earlier, Rob, kind of what the Israeli government's goal is here. I think it is, you know, effectively in the long term to change the government in Iran to something more akin to, you know, what the Shah was, or some kind of friendlier government, right? Less antagonistic, less supportive of resistance groups, less supportive of you know, opposing Israeli domination and aggression.
Yeah. They want another compliant client state.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, I do think that's the case. Israel knows it can't do that itself, and has long wanted the United States to take that on. The United States has not wanted to take that on. And I think that will continue. So you see these kinds of appeals to, you know, Israeli restraint, which I is actually an oxymoron. But the idea that, you know, Israel should not respond to this, or, you know, if it does, it should do so in a manner that will not continue to, quote unquote, escalate the situation. You know, all of this, of course, taking a lot of attention away from the ongoing genocide that Israel is committing in Gaza. You know, I think the idea that now Israel is a victim again is something we see in the kind of political press, but not something that I think I'll say this. I don't think people have turned away from the genocide in Gaza because of what Iran did. That is what we are, I think, meant to kind of think. So now Israel is a victim again. You know, oh, just at a time when certain politicians were starting to finger wag, and just at a time when there were maybe conditions put on, you know, military aid to Israel. Well, now look at what it's facing. I think this is all smoke and mirrors. I mean, if you were getting to a place where you were condemning genocide, what Iran did this past weekend is not going
to
change.
It's back to being fine again now.
It's so like if your perspective has then swung back the other way, then you weren't serious about condemning genocide in the first place. You weren't really becoming an ally, you know, and so I don't think that the calculus has actually changed. I think if you condemn genocide, you should condemn genocide. If you condition arms shipments or stop them altogether, which would be better, but if you condition arms shipments so that they can not be used to commit genocide, that is good. That continues to be the case regardless of what Iran, you know, did this past weekend with drones and missiles. You know, again, this idea that Israel can never, ever, ever be touched by anyone, but it can exact such pain and death and destruction upon countless others, is one of those kind of taken for granted status quo canards. You know, the idea that what Iran did creates a quote unquote new normal, but apparently the old normal of occupation and genocide and ethnic cleansing and apartheid is really just a-okay. And if we could only get back to there, then we're back to the rules-based order.
Yeah. And of course, it's not changing the rules of the game or advocating for a new normal when you bomb other people's embassies and consulates and just expect to have no reaction whatsoever.
It all depends on when history starts.
Yeah, exactly. I guess, Nima, while I still have you, I guess I just wanted to ask about something that I find a little bit frustrating in these moments, which is this kind of tendency among some people in the sort of Western left to decide, like, now is the time to bring out my withering critiques of the Iran regime and this kind of stuff. Like, listen, you know, I'm a secular, progressive Canadian. Like, there's certainly criticisms that I could make of like the government of Iran or any other country, but what I don't really understand is this tendency at this time when there's such a clear sort of demarcation between the sides here on this. And like you pointed out, you have Iran being one of the only countries materially supporting Palestinian resistance and materially standing up to Israel. That to me is just something that, like, if you're against genocide, if you support Palestine and you want it, we want the situation to change, that's something that should be supported. And what I don't really get is this tendency from some people to say, like, whoa, 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 you're supporting Iran now. Whoa, we can criticize Israel, but that doesn't mean we need to back these, whatever all the buzzwords come out, these reactionary fundamentalist.
The Mad Mullahs.
Exactly. So again, like, it's just something, it's this tendency, this kind of very navel gazing kind of tendency that I find really frustrating in these moments. Just wondering what your perspective is on
Yeah,
that
no,
and
I
that
mean,
kind of tendency.
I certainly agree with you. I think criticisms of Iran's government in terms of how it treats its people in Iran are absolutely valid. There's a lot that I personally would want to be different about that country domestically. But I do think that it really, really is a dodge to kind of both sides this when it comes to one side being opposed to genocide, one side not just sitting idly when its consulates are attacked or when its scientists are murdered. And one side being an occupying apartheid state, actively committing genocide. I think it is pretty clear. I don't think that means people have a hard time holding multiple kind of
Yes.
ideas in their head at the same time. I don't think it is always incumbent on someone to say, to be clear, the Iranian government dot dot dot, but also Israel. Like it, you, it's okay to commit to something. It's okay to actually stand for something. And if you stand against genocide, and you stand against the ongoing ethnic cleansing and occupation and annexation of Palestine, then there is really one state around that is actively opposing that and actively supporting those who oppose that in their own land. And that I think does not mean that if you say that or if you support aspects of that that means that all of a sudden you support 100% of every single letter of every law that the Iranian government since 1979 has exacted upon its own population. Certainly not. And I think you can absolutely support domestic movements for justice, of which there are many, whether they are women's movements, whether they are union movements, whether they are artistic movements within Iran, you can absolutely stand on the side of that while opposing genocide in Israel. That is consistent. And also, you don't have to get all fainting couch. You don't have to get the vapors just because you say something nice about the government of Iran. I think you'll be okay. Also, I think it's important to note, those of us who do live in, say, the United States. I'll speak for myself. I think it's more incumbent on us to make sure that our government is not complicit in genocide. It is more incumbent in us to make sure that our government does not continue to support apartheid. And so this kind of offsetting of you know, caring so much about the human rights of others. That is wonderful. I think we all stand for that. That is great. But also making sure that you are acting in ways that actually have the most effect. Solidarity is wonderful. Solidarity is massively important. I do not want to undermine sort of dismiss global solidarity. That is hugely important. But I will also say that there are no movements for justice that I know of in Iran that wish that sanctions continue, that wish that Iran would be invaded or bombed, that wish that Israel continues its genocide. Those are also non-compatible. And so if you are supporting movements for justice in Iran, you are also supporting movements consistently. You would be supporting movements for justice in Palestine as well.
Yeah. And just like, I think people sometimes take for granted the idea that like, if Iran were to undergo some kind of massive shift and go back to being some kind of client state of the United States, that wouldn't necessarily be a great thing for the average Iranian citizen either.
Yeah, you know? I think, yeah, I think any foreign soldier or any, let's say US backed, regime change, entity would be met with the fiercest resistance within Iran, and would be instantly choked to death by Iranian women's chadors.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, and then yeah, just to finish up on that, it's like, you can say whatever you want about the government of Iran, but the fact is, Israel over the last 6 months has engaged in one of the most brutal, barbaric, ongoing crimes that we've seen in modern history, with full support of the United States and Canada and Britain and the whole rest of the rules-based order. So you can have whatever criticisms you want of Iran, but they are not doing that. And they're actively pushing back against that. So what does that say about Canada or the United States?
Right.
If that's your framework that you're going to talk about that with.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, to think about, you know, we only ascribe freedom and liberation in certain ways, or, you know, define democracy in certain ways. You know, the fact that there are still articles or still political statements made, you know, calling Israel the only democracy in the Middle East, and kind of gives away everything.
Yeah.
You know, this is about certain narratives being promoted and certain narratives being pushed to the background. It's about maintaining a certain kind of mythology in the face of some very clear ethical issues. And I think that the idea that Iran needs to be maintained in the kind of Western public mind as this big baddie serves a real purpose in distracting and kind of decreasing focus on the acts of not only some of our very closest allies, but also ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great place to leave it. Nima, thanks so much for coming to talk to me about all this. It was a really fantastic conversation. Before we sign off here, do you just want to let people know where they can find your work and where they can find Citations Needed podcast, which is, again, a podcast that I really recommend people listen to?
Well, thanks so much, Rob. No, it's really been a pleasure. Yeah, folks are interested. I co-host a podcast called Citations Needed with Adam Johnson, who's a incredibly brilliant media critic and a commentator. So that's been going on for nearly 7 years now. We are into our seventh season, and we'll be back very soon with full length episodes. So stay tuned for that. But you can find Citations Needed wherever you find your favorite podcast fare. We're on all those platforms. Of course, you can follow the show on Twitter if that is your want, at Citations Pod. But yeah, you know, sometimes I write for certain magazines and stuff like that, but But we'll see. We'll see the next time I do that. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. It's not always the most regular, but when the times call for it, sometimes I come out of retirement.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. And thanks again, Nemo. It was fantastic to talk to you.
Thanks again, Rob. It's really been a pleasure.